Yeah, check it out. Y'all want to win a free vacation to the jungles of Costa Rica this summer and help support the Scott Horton Show? You can. Joshua Hughes, peace activist and permaculturalist, runs Verd Energia Pacifica, an intentional community in the mountains of Llanos de Puriscal, Costa Rica. And he's offered to raffle off a week's stay to listeners of this show. Airfare is on you, but transportation to and from the airport, as well as a 7-day stay for you and a guest in your own private house with 3 meals a day is covered. You can learn and practice some skills, or just go for a swim in their river, pool, or waterfall, walk jungle trails, enjoy the views, do yoga or dance in the studio, make art, play music, check out a local soccer game, or simply relax in a hammock by the river and read. Raffle tickets are just $50. Stop by scotthorton.org/raffle for details. And anyone who enters will get half off on any future stay down there. scotthorton.org/raffle. All right, y'all, welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, yeah, do that. scotthorton.org/raffle. If you want to take a risk on that. You know, the airfare is on you, like I say there, which is a couple $100. But then you have your own house for a week. And a river to swim in. And an ocean not far away. And if you missed it yesterday, I interviewed Joshua Hughes, who is donating this vacation to help support this show. So you can go and check that out in the archives at scotthorton.org/interviews, or soon anyway. Yeah. So, you know what I should have done from the beginning with that? I'm really not a very good businessman for an ideological capitalist type. I should have made it like, hey, it's a fundraising thing for the show, and anybody who donates at least $50 gets entered into the raffle. Ah, see, doesn't that make sense? Yeah, I think probably that would have been better. So there you go. That's the deal. And of course, as always, anybody who donates $100 or more gets a QR code commodity disc in the mail. And, yeah, what the hell? I guess if you donate $100, then you get both, right? That makes sense. Donate $100, then you get a QR code. I don't know. How much is silver right now? I need a QR code disc to scan and check the instant spot price. Anyway, I don't know. Something like that. Yeah, that sounds fair enough. I said it, didn't I? So, yeah, anybody donates $50 gets a raffle ticket. Anybody donates $100 gets a raffle ticket and a QR code commodity disc in the mail. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it? And then, yeah, well, what the hell? I hardly ever do this NPR-style crap to you guys. I'll try to keep it to a minimum here. Here are ways you can support the show. You can donate by PayPal. You can do a single donation of any amount, or do a monthly subscription. And I know it's kind of like voting. We're like, yeah, what difference does it make if I donate? Hey, it makes a difference. Just a few of you guys doing $5, $10, $20 a month on a regular subscription. That really helps keep the electricity flowing to this radio equipment. And is greatly appreciated. There's also Patreon, which Sheldon Richmond suggested I sign up for, and hadn't really taken off yet. I don't know. Seems like a cool thing. And you can sign up. Maybe it's kind of problematic. You know, he's doing 2 or 3 articles a week. I'm doing, you know, sometimes 10 or 15 interviews a week. Well, usually not that many, but anyway. So I guess maybe I can see why people are reluctant to sign up on a per-interview basis. But if you want to donate on a per-interview basis, you just go to patreon.com/ScottHortonShow. I also take bitcoins. If you have my old address from a long, long time ago, don't send bitcoins to that, because that was on a disk that got crashed and erased and eaten and destroyed. But I got a new one. Just look at scotthorton.org/donate there, or scotthorton.org/support, and you can get to that Bitcoin address. Oh, that reminds me. I was supposed to check my email back about that guy with the thing. And then, oh, yeah, Amazon.com. Some of you people have been doing your shopping by way of Amazon.com, the link on my site, scotthorton.org, or you can just go scotthorton.org/Amazon. It will forward you on, and yeah, trust me, it works. go to scotthorton.org/Amazon or just go to my site and click the Amazon link on the right side of the page there before you go doing your shopping. And, yeah, that really helps. And especially some people are getting, you know, high-end audio equipment or, you know, appliances for the kitchen and these kinds of things, which, hey, that's life. You got to do these things anyway. You might as well do it through scotthorton.org/Amazon. And, yeah, believe me, that's a really good one. I really should promote that more. It ain't just books. They sell everything in the whole world there. And there are, apparently, there are a few people who've decided to make it a habit to always stop by my site first before they go there. And, man, I sure do appreciate that. It's working out. So, thanks very much. And, most importantly, I would encourage you to advertise on the show. I got a new one lined up coming on, in just a couple of weeks, beginning of next month. Really looking forward to that.
Huh?
Really looking forward to that. There was an extra, some kind of nonsense word in there. Really looking forward to that. I encourage you also to advertise on the show. I need to do a better job of hunting down possible advertisers and, you know, seeing what they say. But anyway, if you feel like coming to me about it, you own a company, or you run some kind of business or nonprofit organization or whatever it is you want to advertise on the show, talk to me. My rates are reasonable, and do what I can for you. So just go to scotthorton.org/support, and you can find out more about that. Really, just email me, scott@scotthorton.org, if you're interested in advertising on the show. All right, so that's the raffle, the disc, Patreon, PayPal, Bitcoin, Amazon, advertising, and announcing. And I'm kind of a little bit ahead of the thing here announcing it, but not really. It's already on audible.com, and I guess it has its own page at Amazon somewhere, but it's not quite connected to the other versions of the book yet or whatever. Anyway, I did the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's book, Fascism versus Capitalism, and it is now available at audible.com. So if you like listening to me talk, and you like reading Lou Rockwell books, a great collection of essays by Lou Rockwell, then check it out. It's Fascism versus Capitalism, the audiobook version published by Listen and Think Audio. And it's me reading a book of Lou. That's cool. Oh, I should have had him on the show today to talk about it. Well, maybe we'll do that Monday. And you get it free with a 30-day trial membership. Find the link in the right-hand margin at my site, scotthorton.org, or just type in audibletrial.com/scotthortonshow, audibletrial.com/scotthortonshow, and you can get it free with a 30-day trial membership. If you already have an account at Audible, then it's $20, looks like here. So check it out. Fascism versus Capitalism, written by Lou Rockwell. Llewellyn H. Rockwell Jr., that is. And narrated by me, Scott Horton. So there's a way for me to make some money, I hope. A little bit of residuals. If I can convince Lou to promote it on his website, that sure would help. But there you go. So brand new out. Just came out yesterday. The audiobook of Fascism versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell. It's available at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, or just follow the link to Audible in the right-hand margin of my website, or just type in Audible, Scott Horton, Lou Rockwell, Fascism versus Capitalism, or something like that. It'll come right up for you, and it'll be available on Amazon.com where you can find it. It's already there somewhere, but you'll be able to find it soon. Oh, and iTunes.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee.
darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Again, doing my spring fundraiser here. Anybody who donates $50 or more gets a raffle ticket for a chance to win a trip to Costa Rica. You and a friend or a spouse or a whoever for a week. Go stay in the jungle. Check it all out at scotthorton.org/raffle. And, of course, anybody who donates $100 or more gets a QR code commodity disc. All right, and then a million things going on, man. I don't know. I only got a two-hour show. WikiLeaks has just released 60,000 State Department cables from Saudi Arabia. I presume that means from the American embassy in Saudi Arabia back home. Wow. I wonder what all is in there. And you know what else I wonder? Wow. I wonder who's giving this stuff to Julian Assange. This ain't the Bradley Manning caper here. This is something else entirely. Chelsea Manning. No offense intended. All right, man. I love WikiLeaks. You know, if you're bad on WikiLeaks, you should question whether you're a bad person. Oh, yeah. It just makes me so upset that people can liberate government documents and put them online, or journalists can journalism them. Ooh, that just makes me furious. You know why? Because government was on TV and told me to be furious. Stop telling me the truth about all the horrible things you're doing with my money and my name. I don't want to know about it. All right. So that's cool. I don't know anything about it yet. Brand new out. But we'll see what happens there. And then also I wanted to point out... global conflicts cost 13. What the? Oh, something is auto playing on my. Yeah, that's bad. Well, it could have been worse, I guess. Global conflicts cost 13% of world GDP, according to a report by the Institute of Economics and Peace. Man, I should have turned this into an interview. Anyway, think about that. Assuming that that's true, which, you know, I don't know, hell, I guess I'd believe it if you gave me a higher number than that, really. Global conflicts cost 13% of world GDP. In other words, wealth. The standard of living of real people destroyed in these conflicts. And to a huge degree, I mean, think about that. That's conflicts around the globe last year cost $14 trillion. Wait a minute. Yeah? Wow. Because, see, it's not just the costs. I don't know how they measure it, but there are, of course, all the unseen costs. Not just the cost of the weapons and the cost of the funerals, but all of the wealth that never was produced on the destroyed property by the dead people that would have been. And whatever other, you know, secondary effects from there, too. So anyway, just a little food for thought, I thought. And then someone sent me this the other day, and I can understand why they could say, oh, this is really sad, but I'm with it, man. I think this is great. Or at least I understand why, and I'm wondering what's been taking everybody else so long, I guess. Ken Walsh's article at U.S. News and World Report. Americans have lost confidence in everything. It's not just Congress and the economy that Americans are concerned about these days. They don't believe in the presidency. They don't believe in the Supreme Court. They don't believe in the Congress. They don't believe in the banks. They don't believe in organized religion. Only the military. Oh, my God. You know, We are in such bad shape here in America right now. Only the military, in which 72% of Americans express confidence, up from a historical average of 68%, and small business with 67% confidence, up from 63%, are currently higher rated than their historical norms. Everything else is down. That's good to see about small business. Of course, what's wrong with big business is politics. There's nothing wrong necessarily with a giant corporation with an economy of scale creating goods at cheap prices, accumulating massive amounts of capital to reinvest. That's all fine. It's just that we all know that with big business comes access to big government and violent force, favoritism and corruption. But anyway, and it's really sad that the military is the only thing that Americans believe in. Because, of course, what that means is times ever get really, really bad, like the politicians and the military succeed in wasting so much fake, computerized, printed money that they destroy the American currency and bring the empire down to its knees. Of course, all we need in a situation like that to recover, as my would-be guest, I was hoping Ron Paul would have said, is freedom. We don't need the military to take over rationing, to declare martial law to protect us from whatever it is that ails us. All we need is free floating prices on the market and private property rights, and we can figure it out. The only thing Americans believe in is the generals. Anyway, so forget that. That is the negative part. But the part that I like is 28% have confidence in banks, down from 40. 21% have confidence in big business, down from 24. 24% have confidence in organized labor, down from 26. 24% have confidence in newspapers, down from 32. And, you know, it's just like Bill Hicks would have said, exactly, pretty much, I think, that the reason that our institutions are all crumbling is because they're no longer relevant. You know, there's no reason to think that we have to be married to however the current status quo is now. Why should we be? No confidence. And now that's going to be a problem if we have a military dictatorship to replace what was supposed to be a temporary limited constitutional republic here. That's the wrong kind of confidence. But, you know, their heart's in the right place. I saw a poll once where people in super majorities said that the media ought to all have to check everything they publish with the government first to make sure that it's right. Don't! Stupid idiots. But then, you know, a friend pointed out to me that, look, obviously that's ridiculous. But the point is that they don't trust the media. That's really what they're getting to, right? They just don't trust it. It's been proven false to them too many times. Now, the idea that having the government check everything first is how to make sure that it's correct, well, that's the kind of stupid thing they would have learned listening to the media. But it does show that their heart is in the right place. They want the truth, and they don't believe they're getting it. So there's the silver lining on it. You know what I mean? And I got a proposition for you. Ron Paul would have put it a lot better than me if I had succeeded in getting him on the show for you today. But that is, he would have said something along the lines of, it's the empire that ails us. We just don't need it. It's what's bogging us down. It's what's dividing us from each other. It's what's breaking our bank. It's what's corrupting our business. It's what's turning the police on the people. It's ruining everything. So just come home.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
Hey, y'all, run out and get a copy of Embedded Alive, First-Person Journalism in the United States of America, 2013 through 14, by Chris Braswell. The book takes a gonzo look at daily life in America, columns, informational letters, and other marketplace vigilance, a look at drug abuse culture and its marketing, and a series of contemplative and metaphysical essays. Get Embedded Alive,
first-person journalism in the United States of America, 2013 through 14, in paperback, hardcover, and digital formats at fusepowder.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I got Phil Giraldi on the line. Seems like kind of pretty much a regular Friday thing, I guess because he writes on Thursdays. Hey, welcome back. How you doing, Phil?
I'm fine, Scott. How about you?
I'm doing real good. Hey, listen, so you are the executive director of the Council for the National Interest. You write for UNS.com and the American Conservative Magazine, which is where you wrote this one. Israel battles the boycotts. The BDS movement is now drawing official opposition from Tel Aviv and its American allies. I think we're running this on antiwar.com today or yesterday. So very well done piece here. Very thorough investigation of what the Israelis are attempting to do about the BDS movement. Can you, first of all, please just tell us about BDS, how long it's been around, how effective it is, what is the dang deal?
Well, yeah, basically it's a nonviolent movement. It was founded by a number of Palestinian organizations and individuals in I think 2005, 2006. And the idea was to put economic pressure on Israel, somewhat akin to the kinds of pressure that was put on South Africa and that Gandhi employed in India to bring about change in the political status quo in those places. Essentially, it focuses primarily on the settlements, because the settlements for Palestinians obviously is a big issue, and there's been a growing movement in Europe in particular and increasingly in the United States to not buy products or to avoid companies that operate in the occupied territories and not buy the kind of products that they're producing. So it's a nonviolent, it's a non-confrontational way to pressure a government or a system to change.
And now, you know, I guess, I don't know, do you know anybody who knows how they treat this in the Israeli media? When I read the Netanyahu himself and then, you know, all his sock puppets saying, oh, yeah, see how much everybody just hates Jews and just pretending that they've never heard of the occupation. What occupation? Occupation doesn't have a damn thing to do with any of this. I never even heard of that anyway. Who's occupying who? I don't know what you're talking about. Is that the way they treat this in the Israeli media, too? That this is not a boycott because people are upset about the endless occupation of the millions of Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip? And they really just say, nope, they just don't like it because of what racist they all are. End of argument. Is anybody buying that?
Well, I think clearly a lot of Israelis and know what the score is. In fact, if you go to the Israeli media, the more liberal media, and I would cite Haaretz as being the exemplar of that, they have articles that are very specific on these issues. And while not actually supporting boycotts, they're laying out the case in very clear terms. I think the thing we have to watch here is that because Netanyahu and his friends are all now citing the boycott, the BDS, as being an existential threat to Israel, and also claiming that this is like Nazism, a return of Nazism, it shows that the Israeli ruling elite is panicking about this. They recognize that this is something real. I mean, this is something that actually can change things. And I think that's the kind of panic we're seeing here. Every Israeli, unless they're totally brain dead, knows damn well that what they're doing on the West Bank is wrong. But they have self-interest in doing it. And just as the Americans had self-interest in occupying the West and driving out the Indians. So, you know, there's always an argument. But the fact is, I think you would have to be blind, deaf, and dumb, really, to not understand that there are real issues here, and the real issues are so clear, and they're so critical of what the Israelis are doing. The Israelis realize that they don't really have a good defense.
Mm-hmm. Well, I forget, was it Abraham Lincoln who said, you can fool some of the people all the time, and those are the ones you want to focus on?
I don't think he put it that way, but yeah, that's probably what he meant.
So, I mean, that's what's really going on here. It's like, oh, look, everybody, they're Nazis. Don't look into it. And so that'll work on some people, but not on everybody else.
It'll work on the U.S. Congress, that's for sure.
Right, yeah, for sure. But now, then again, it does seem like they're actually just conceding the argument. They're not saying, hey, listen, we have to occupy the West Bank because of some bogus security reason or whatever, you know, make up something. They're basically conceding, all right, Phil, you're right. We're stealing the West Bank, and the Palestinians can just lay down and die if they don't like it. We're not going to stop. And so, you know, full-scale war against all who oppose us.
Well, basically, I mean, this new Israeli government has a bunch of bigots that are built right into it. I mean, the previous one was no great shakes, and with Naftali Bennett and, you know, and Avigdor Lieberman. But now they have a deputy foreign minister who says it's too bad, Palestinians. The whole of historic Palestine belongs to us. It's ours. And then they have the guy who's actually spearheading the government effort against BDS for Netanyahu has more than once said that the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, should not have any non-Jews in it at all. So this is the type of democracy that these people accept, and the kind of I would call it bigotry that they represent.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but their new justice minister, that's AKA their John Ashcroft, their attorney general, Eric Holder, I forgot the new lady's name, is the one who was saying, oh, yeah, no, they're all our enemy. They're babies and their grandmothers and everyone. They must be destroyed and all that kind of crap. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's correct. Yeah,
I mean, we're talking about this is John Ashcroft doesn't talk like that even about Al-Qaeda, right? Or, you know what I mean? American attorney generals don't say that about grandmothers and babies in any context.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, this is the reality of the Israeli government, which, of course, doesn't come through in the media reports that we get here in the United States. I mean, it's still, they treat Israel like it's a legitimate democracy. Well, I mean, you know, when the Nazis took over in Germany, I hate to myself use the Nazi analogy, but the fact is when the Nazis took over, they took over democratically. And that didn't make them any more sane in terms of the policies that they were endorsing. The fact that, a government was elected in Israel and had to move sharply to the right to get the kind of support it needed to have a majority in the Knesset, it doesn't mean anything in terms of democratic principles, because there are no democratic principles there. If you're an Arab, whether you're a Christian or a Muslim, you're a second-class citizen, even if you have an Israeli passport. And if you're an Arab living on the West Bank, you have no rights whatsoever. You're under occupation.
Yeah. Well, how different is this? I was too young back at the time, Phil, but the position now of these people in Netanyahu's government, in his coalition government here, their stated positions, because don't get me wrong, Ashcroft and Holder, their governments, they sure kill grandmothers and babies all the time. They just don't talk like that. But, I mean, that's pretty frank language that, as you say, is not shared with the American people on our TV news, for example, that kind of thing. But how different is their position from that of the old Rabbi Kahane, who was actually the first Al-Qaeda target assassinated in America, New York City, in 1989, who was once, his party was banned by the Israeli Supreme Court, labeled him fascist, and banned from participating in Israeli politics. But did he say or do anything that was crazier and further to the right than the positions of the current attorney general and the current deputy foreign minister over there?
No, and that's the depressing thing. This whole situation has moved dramatically to the right, and things that were, you know, 30 years ago would have been labeled even by most sensible Israelis as racist are now now common gruel in the media, and it's the real tragedy of the situation. We're having an openly racist regime, and Netanyahu is a racist. I mean, let's not be nice about him either. Right. I mean, the guy basically, his colors came out in the election.
Yeah, yeah, no, I'm sorry. We got to take this break, but we'll pick it up right there on the other side of it with Netanyahu's bigotry, because that is an important topic. Hang on.
Okay.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Talking with Phil Giraldi from the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and the American Conservative Magazine, where he's written Israel Battles the Boycotts. And we're going to get into those specifics here in a minute. But where we're interrupted by the break, Phil, we're talking about what a racist and a bigot Benjamin Netanyahu is. And I'm actually a little bit glad of that, because I think his obvious racial contempt for our president from the very beginning, oh, I don't mean our president like I love him or anything, but just I think the fact that he's always treated Obama like, get down on your knees and shine my shoes, boy, is exactly why Obama's reaction has been, oh, yeah, you shine my shoes, dude. Who's the emperor here? Me, not you. And has helped to make things less bad than they could have been. Compared to, say, if we'd had, you know, Mitt Romney, Netanyahu's best friend in there, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I was pointing out, you know, just before the break that Netanyahu in the last election in Israel made very clear where he comes from. And he basically said to get the vote out for his supporters that there will be no Palestinian state on his watch. And that's a pretty clear statement. And then I think more revolting than that, he also called his people to get out and vote, saying, if you don't do it, all these Arabs are rushing to the polls and they're going to vote. And you know, you can't, if you make a racist comment like that in the United States, you would be in big trouble. But apparently in Israel, this passes for normal.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, in fact, I wish I had it in front of me or something, but I read one translation of that where it was actually, he used all militarized language too, where, you know, there are legions of them descending or where, I forgot the language, but it was all kind of military terminology, like they were all under some central command ordering them to march. They're marching on the polling stations, you know, and all this kind of thing, invading them. I don't know if he said invading, but along those lines.
I think you're right. Actually, I did see a translation that was what it suggested. And one of the commenters said something. This is obviously a Masada complex type response from him to say that, you know, like the Romans were coming to overthrow the Third Temple or something like that.
Yeah. And yeah, exactly. Put the shoe on the other foot. Imagine a Republican or a Democrat said that about American Jews. Oh, the Jews are coming out in droves to vote. They're marching. They're descending. And what would happen to them? I mean, that'd be their last day, probably even living in the country, never mind running for office.
Exactly.
Absolutely insane to even imagine that someone would say that, to think that they could get away with talking like that in this country, seeking power. All right, so now they're doing something about it, and by they, that is the government of Israel and the leaders of the Israel lobby in the United States, the new de facto leader, Sheldon Adelson. Tell us all about it.
Well, to me, the real scary aspect of all this is, all right, fine. Let's just accept the fact that the Palestinians are doing what they can legally and justifiably, I think, to put pressure on the Israelis. And the Israelis are responding. Okay, that's business as usual. But what's scary is that Israel's friends in the United States are picking up on this. And Adelson is funding this effort, obviously. And Congress is on board. I mean, Congress is basically attached to the recent omnibus European trade bill, an amendment that makes anybody engaging in an anti-Israeli boycott, meaning any country in Europe, that issue would be a primary issue in our negotiations with the country. So in other words, it's no longer a question of what's good in terms of American interests in business. It's a question of how are they, what are they doing with Israel? And during the past week, we had, or 2 weeks ago, we had a South Carolina legislature made it illegal for any business or any entity to do business with the state of South Carolina if they are in any way boycotting Israel. And New York State has had a bill saying that, supported apparently by Ted Cruz, among others, that any college or university that passes a resolution boycotting Israel is going to be cut off from funding, is going to be cut off from any support from the federal government. So this is something that goes way beyond any kind of disagreement about what is going on in the Middle East. This is basically abridging our First Amendment rights, and it also is abridging our rights to deal with situations in a peaceful way. I mean, this is quite incredible.
Yeah, boy, that's really something. Now, one of the things in there that I read, and it's in your piece, I believe, almost positive. Yeah, the make you unemployable thing here, where actually targeting. Is this correct? Uh-huh. They're targeting students active in BDS to where wherever you get a job, we're going to follow you on your Facebook page, whatever it is. We're going to find out wherever you apply for a job. We're going to do everything we can to intervene and prevent you from being employable in your future if you dare to protest against Israel while you're a college student.
Yeah, this is a website called Canary Mission. And it's quite scary. It basically, it's a website that's funded probably by Adelson, although the funding is not public, so you don't know whose money is behind it. Might even be the Israeli government. What it does is identify Muslim Americans who support the BDS movement, and it puts their pictures up on the website, puts their names, it puts information on where they live, and it basically it threatens. That let me quote it, because they say, we believe in the right of employers to know which potentially threatening organizations prospective employees were affiliated with during their time on campus. In other words, it's trying to make these kids unemployable. It's going to harass them and go after them to make them unemployable. I find this very un-American.
Yeah, no, it's McCarthyite kind of tactics, but in that sense, I think it's going to blow up in their face. They're going to be surprised how many employers say, oh, yeah, really? Well, good. I'm going to give you a 10% bonus. I hate Israel, too. I'm so sick and tired of them. Like, that's tattletaling on someone to say that they're against the occupation. Good for you, kid. Welcome aboard.
Yeah, well, I hope that's true. And I hope Americans kind of wake up to this. I mean, this is, you know, essentially, we have people in this country who have a lot of political power and have a lot of money and basically are willing to use that power and use that money to abridge the rights of people who are doing things that are perfectly legal and perfectly peaceful. And it's, this is, goes way beyond arguing an issue with somebody about, you know, do you believe this or do you believe that? This is basically threatening people in very open ways to make them change their political views and to change their opinions of things that are going on in the world.
And now let me go back to the trade agreement thing too, where are you talking about this could get between America and our biggest trading partners in Europe if they have or if they participate in BDS in any sense, that would prevent America from their previous trade relations or upcoming adjustments to our trade relations with our European allies?
The intention of this is to have it as an element in the trade negotiations going ahead from now. So basically, if, say the Italian government decides to boycott products from the Israeli settlements, the United States negotiator with Italy would lay this out as an issue that he wants to have addressed. He'll use it as a negative against the Italians. And the interesting thing about this is it's the way the thing is written by Congress. It's not just Israel. It includes any space occupied by Israel. So that includes all the West Bank and includes anywhere that Israel deems to consider part of its part of its area of control. The whole thing is astonishing.
Yeah, no. Hey, did you see the letter? And I take Phil Weiss at his word. I think he must be right about this, that American Gentiles sort of feel like they need a little bit of a permission slip from Jews to oppose Israeli policy because they're afraid of being accused of being anti-Semitic, and how important it is that people know the truth that there are many Jews not only in BDS but even leading the BDS movement. And the question I was going to ask, if I could ever get to it, is did you see the letters in the Washington Post where they published two pretty important letters to the editor saying from leaders of Jewish organizations saying that we support this and there's nothing anti-Semitic about it. Everybody else come on board.
Yeah, there were two very good letters. One of them was by Alan Braunfeld, and they made that point very clearly. Israel is a foreign country. Judaism is a religion. And the fact is they're trying to conflate the two to make opposition or support of BDS anti-Semitism, which it's not. But if you read today's Washington Post, there were two letters saying just the opposite. So it's like, you know, this kind of game going back and forth. But Braunfeld is absolutely right. And, of course, he's been saying this for years. He says, you know, if you're an American Jew, you're an American. And you're Jewish because that's your religion, if you choose to worship it. But he says, if you're an American citizen, your loyalty is the United States. It's not to Israel. And essentially, this is something we're losing in translation.
Mm-hmm. And Braunfeld, he's no slouch either. Can you tell us a little bit about his background?
Yeah, Alan is a very good guy. He's very active. He's the head of the American Council for Judaism, which is a major Jewish organization, and it essentially represents includes a lot of rabbis, and it represents Jews that recognize this fact that there is a separation between Israel, the country, and Judaism as the religion. And he's been talking about this for years and years and years. He's probably the best spokesman on it. And, of course, this goes to the heart of the matter. I mean, to what extent can Netanyahu claim that someone who supports a boycott is an anti-Semite? You know, it clearly is an overreach on the part of Netanyahu, but nobody in our system, meaning the mainstream media or the government, is going to challenge him on it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I saw a thing, I guess I only saw the secondhand reports about a Rand Corporation study saying that BDS is really costing the Israelis a lot of money and it could cost them tens of billions of dollars over the coming years. And, you know, this is really why they're reacting like this. This is
And there's also the psychological factor. You know, like 2 weeks ago, there was that an impending boycott of Israel by the Football Association, FIFA, and that was disrupted by the United States intervening with those arrests. And the Israelis were traumatized by that. They were afraid that they were going to get kicked out of international sports and everything like that, which would be the same thing that happened to South Africa. Mm-hmm. And it was a major element in getting the South African situation to change.
Oh, but I'm sure those arrests had absolutely nothing to do with the policy that was going on.
Yeah, right. And I've got the Brooklyn Bridge to sell you.
Yeah. All right. Well, how much? I don't know. I'll trade you some swampland for it.
Okay.
All right. Hey, thanks for coming back on the show, Phil. Appreciate it.
All right, Scott. Good to talk to you.
See ya. All right, that's Phil Giralli. He's at the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org, UNZ.com, UNZ.com. And the American Conservative Magazine. This one is Israel Battles the Boycotts. Hey, I'll Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org for the archives. LRN.FM, noon to two weekdays here, the Liberty Radio Network. All right, next up, also from the American Conservative Magazine, it's our friend Daniel Larrison. Welcome back to the show, Daniel. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Scott. Thanks. Thanks for having me back.
Good. Very happy to have you here. The appalling war on Yemen. The starvation of Yemen. The war on Yemen and our useless regional clients. Well, it's all one big article here, I guess. And we'll get to Clinton and the Democrats maybe in the second segment. But could you please, I guess, give us a thumbnail, kind of an update on the situation as it stands right now, and I guess particularly with an eye to that starvation bit there?
Yeah, of course. So the Saudis and their regional allies, most of the members of the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council, the Egyptians, along with support from the U.S., have been bombing Yemen pretty much continuously for the last 12 weeks. And more important in terms of the humanitarian effect, they've been imposing an air and sea blockade on the country, which has provided, which has prevented necessities such as food and medicine and fuel from being imported into the country. Yemen is an extremely poor country to start with. It was already very heavily dependent on aid and outside imports. And unfortunately, because of the blockade, those imports are not being allowed in the quantities that are required to sustain the population. And so there is now a great concern in many, many parts of Yemen. People are now, many millions of people are at risk of starvation. Many millions more are going hungry. And this will continue to get worse as long as the blockade is in place. And indeed, the starvation article that I was writing was emphasizing that really near famine conditions are being created in parts of the country because they can't get the food that is required. And so this is a really an extraordinary and kind of horrifying picture of what's happened since the intervention started in March. And it is due almost entirely to the actions of the Saudis, which, of course, our government has been supporting.
Man, yeah, and it's been reported early on by, I guess, the international organizations, NGOs and UN-type organizations. I know Patrick Coburn has been writing this, and Jason Ditz has been writing that this country, previous to the war, imported 90% of their food. So, in other words, you know, you better get your regime change done in a week or two and get back to business as fast as you can, or we're going to have an absolute humanitarian catastrophe here. And here we are, as you said, 12 weeks in. And are people starving to death at this point, or they're just going really, really hungry, eating dirt?
They soon will be if they don't get food supplies. The 6 million figure that was given by the World Food Program indicates people that are in need of emergency food assistance, which is essentially one step removed from being in a famine.
And you also point out the dengue fever and just the lack of medicine and the breakdown in trade and distribution of all kinds of important goods like that.
Well, that's right. So the need for medicine is very great, of course, because of injuries from the war and also because of diseases that are being created due to poor sanitation. And that's being caused in large part because there's no fuel to run the generators in order to keep clean access to water. Because a lot of the water that they have in Yemen relies on pumps from wells, and those have to be fueled by gas when the power is out. Of course, lots of the power infrastructure has been destroyed by the bombing. So it's, each part of the campaign has reinforced every problem that Yemen has and made it worse.
All right, now, well, I guess you could pick these topics in whichever order you prefer. The goals of the Saudis and how well they line up with their tactics and strategy for accomplishing those goals, and then, you know, in the other order, whichever you prefer, the so-called peace talks that have broken out. Are they getting anywhere? Is there a chance for a ceasefire and some kind of negotiated settlement short of a so-called victory?
Well, so I'll start with the ceasefire negotiations or the attempt to have ceasefire negotiations. The UN has been brokering talks or trying to broker talks in Geneva this week. it's got off to a slow start. The Houthi delegation was delayed in arriving in Geneva. And then once they did arrive, they and the side representing the official government, or the deposed government, really, would not meet with each other. So the envoy had to go back and forth between them to convey their messages to each other. And both sides' positions have hardened considerably over the course of the last 2.5, 3 months because of the war. And there's really very little movement on either side towards any sort of compromise that would bring the war to a conclusion. One of the reasons that the Houthis have not been interested in giving any ground is that so far they've been gaining on the ground in Yemen while the air campaign against them has been going on. So one of the main ostensible goals of the Saudi campaign to drive the Houthis back into their stronghold has utterly failed. The other main goal that the Saudis have to restore the deposed president to power is as far from reality as can be. In the process of waging war on Yemen with Hadi's support, President Hadi's support, Hadi has made himself hateful to most of his countrymen, understandably. So there's really no realistic prospect of him coming back to power at the head of a Saudi force. The other supposed goal of the Saudi campaign is to repel Iranian influence, but since Iranian influence in Yemen before the campaign was negligible, there's really no way for them to achieve that either. In fact, to the extent that there is Iranian influence in Yemen today, it's probably gotten a bit stronger simply because the Iranians are exploiting the opening created by the campaign.
Yeah. Now, is it too simple to say that Obama could make them call it off and knock it off? He could just cease providing American support. I don't want to overstate it, but I think the Wall Street Journal made it pretty clear that it's American boats and American planes in the sky that are basically running the war.
Well, certainly U.S. support in terms of weapons deliveries and refueling make it much easier for the Saudis to carry out the campaign at the rate that they're carrying it out. I think if we withdrew that support, it would be much more difficult for them to carry on, and they would have to reassess whether they want to persist in that campaign. Now, it's possible that they might still want to do that, that they might keep the blockade in place, in which case Yemen would still be in terrible shape. But I think the U.S. could make it very clear that it doesn't endorse what the Saudis have been doing, or no longer endorses what the Saudis are trying to do, and call off that aid. But there seems to be no inclination to do that. You see a lot of these anonymous quotes in news stories from various officials from the administration saying that they're very concerned about civilian casualties and so on. Mm. But they're not actually doing anything that would indicate that that concern trumps their desire to reassure the Saudis. And this whole emphasis on trying to reassure them, I think, is misguided, because clearly no matter how much support we give them, they will always think that it's not enough. So we're essentially trying to bribe them with our support, and they're not interested in doing anything that we recommend after that.
Yeah. All right, well, I'm going to try to do this right for once, Daniel. We are talking with Daniel Larrison, that is Make the Break on Time. We're talking with Daniel Larrison from the American Conservative Magazine. He's written quite a few pieces recently, and thank goodness, too, because a lot of people just aren't doing the work on this. They're letting it go by and be somebody else's responsibility. Here at the American Conservative Magazine, keeping up with the war on Yemen. When we get back, we'll talk more about prospects for peace here and maybe what could be done about it on our end to try to do something. I don't know. And maybe what's really going on here in the larger regional context, too. Hang tight. Right back after this. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, y'all, welcome back. I need to trade in this one for something a little more fun. Do you think? Yeah. All right, I got Daniel Larrison on the line from the American Conservative magazine, theamericanconservative.com/Larrison, talking about the appalling war on Yemen. And, you know, I guess you kind of already answered this a bit, Daniel, but, you know, in the big sense, why do we do this? Why is the U.S. government going along with this? How much control, how much responsibility really sits in D.C. versus Riyadh for the decisions being made here? And why would they do such a thing as work so hard to overthrow the Houthis? And what the hell do the Americans care if the Houthis are there? And especially when the consequences are their opposition, who, assuming that their policy even worked, as you said, the Houthis are doing better and better the more we bomb the country here. But assuming that it even worked, it would be directly to the benefit, and it is to some degrees to the benefit of Al-Qaeda. And then, on the other hand, communists, avowed Marxists. What are we doing over here? Why is the U.S. security state, they could have picked any side on this thing and had just as good an argument for what they're doing right now.
Well, right. I think one of the things that happened is that the Saudis decided that they were going to go ahead and do this out of their exaggerated fear of Iran, or their desire simply to smash Yemen and keep it subordinate to them. And they were going to go ahead and do this. We jumped on the bandwagon, bizarrely, because there is this desire to make it seem as if we are always supporting the Gulf states. Is that this anxiety that we're not supporting them enough? And then this is all tied in with the debate over the nuclear deal with Iran, that if we don't do enough to reassure the Gulf states that they will go in directions we don't want with regard to nuclear proliferation, or that they will drift out of our orbit. Why we would be worried about them drifting out of our orbit, I'm not sure. Seeing the way that they've behaved over the last few years in particular, you would think we would like to be rid of them. Mm-hmm. These are governments that have sponsored or have certainly abetted the rise of jihadist groups all over the region, especially in Syria. And they're now, as you say, fighting a war that is redounding to the benefit of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So there's not really anything these clients are doing for us that merits all of the support that we're giving them as it is.
Do these Israelis? I
think that that's the motive, is to try to demonstrate that the U.S. is fully supporting them.
Yeah. Now, do the Israelis have a policy on Yemen? I guess they
I
must.
They
it's
have,
part of the gate of the Red Sea.
I think they don't have a real policy as such, except to broadcast the alarmist claims about Iranian influence expanding into Yemen. Netanyahu was one of the first people to repeat what's basically a lie, that Iran controls Sana'a, the capital of Yemen. Iran doesn't have control over any part of Yemen. But this is a convenient story that opponents of the nuclear deal want to tell, because it makes Iran seem more menacing and more alarming in terms of its growing regional power. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if they're already doing this before we lift sanctions, imagine what they'll do after the sanctions have been lifted. That's the story the Iran hawks want to tell. And so the Israeli government has been echoing that line. But it's basically just propaganda. Mm-hmm. I think the Israelis, to the extent that they have a position, they're willing to endorse what the Saudis are doing, because they also see it as an attack on Iranian interests. Despite the fact that, again, Iranian interests in Yemen are minimal to non-existent. So a lot of it is just fueled by paranoia about Iran, and it's not really based in anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess in that sense, they could be talking about a fictional Yemen. It's just basically an extra in the movie that they're directing here. That, oh, look, the expansion of the Iranian Empire throughout the region. It's just something to say,
right.
Not really a thing.
That's right, and it's mostly used as a foil to justify the aggressive policies that they and the Saudis want to pursue in the region for their own reasons.
All right, now, is there any real risk that the Saudis might actually get what they want here and help flying help with the USAF having their back, flying as Al-Qaeda's Air Force to dislodge and take Sana back and kick the Houthis out. After all, Americans can put firepower on targets if it comes down to it, right?
Yes, although I mean, the U.S. is not directly participating in the bombing in terms of actually dropping bombs on the Houthis. So they're
either picking
there
the targets. They're doing the pudding, in a sense, right?
That's true. That's true.
And they're all flying American F-16s and F-15s, right?
That's also true. But in terms of actually expelling the Houthis from the territory that they control, that would require some sort of formidable ground force that would be able to do that. And right now the Saudis seem unwilling to commit their own forces to do that for fear of being humiliated and for fear of being dragged into a land war in Yemen, which, of course, did not work out very well for the Egyptians when they tried something similar in the 60s. So there's a great reluctance on their part to commit to a ground war, and the forces on the ground that are fighting against the Houthis are mostly not capable of taking the territory away from them. They're mostly trying to hold their own ground in the south of the country. And a large number of the people fighting against the Houthis right now come from the Southern Secessionist movement that aspire to recreate the old South Yemen, which was incorporated into Yemen back in the 90s. So the goals of the ground forces that are most capable of opposing the Houthis right now are not the same as the goals of the Saudis and their allies. And so it seems very unlikely that the Saudis will actually succeed in anything that they've claimed that they want to do.
Well, and now Al-Qaeda is saying that their leader was killed in a drone strike there in Yemen. So I guess now we'll see what happens with the new leadership there and whether they decide to join the Islamic State or stay loyal to Zawahiri. And there could be all kinds of consequences coming from that. The decapitation strikes, a lot of times the spooks live to regret them. You know, others die, but they live to regret them.
And speaking of Islamic State or ISIS, there are bombings claimed by people that say that they're in league with ISIS that took place against Shiite mosques in Sana'a, I believe. So there are already indications that people that are at least claiming to belong to ISIS or to be in league with them are making headway in Yemen as well.
Yeah. Now, I don't know exactly how strong it was, but we should mention that when all the protest movement came together to overthrow Saleh in 2011, they had their plans for their own new government before the Americans and the Saudis came and foisted Hadi on them in their one-man election. And it may or may not have worked out, and there may have turned out to be a civil war anyway, but there's been intervention here. A counter-revolution against the Arab Springs was led to this massive war now. And we always truncate the antecedents, you know?
No, that's right. And the current campaign really is an attempt to try to reimpose the government that was already once imposed on the country. Which obviously most of the people are not interested in having back. So the idea, which is often voiced in sort of pro-Saudi arguments, that this is somehow for the benefit of people in Yemen, is just completely delusional and obviously untrue.
Yeah. Well, Jason Ditz is reporting today that a fistfight broke out at the meeting there in Geneva on Thursday, so you know, maybe they can do a little bit better, and we'll see if we can. I don't know if there's going to be any kind of end to this soon, but I guess maybe it is serving to benefit the arms manufacturers. If nobody else, they get to empty some inventories and refill them again, huh?
Well, unfortunately, they seem to be, aside from jihadists, they seem to be the only ones that would benefit from any of this, yeah.
Yeah. Aside from the jihadists, of course, just like in all of our policies. Whether we're fighting them or fighting against them, it's still always to their benefit, isn't it? All right.
Seems to work that way, yeah.
All right. Hey, thanks very much for coming back on the show, Daniel. I sure appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Good to talk to you again. That's the great Daniel Larrison, everybody. He's at the American Conservative magazine, runs a great anti-war blog there, theamericanconservative.com. We'll be right back. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Yeah, I blew the second break. I always do. Sorry about that. Hey, that's a good incentive for you to go sign up for the podcast feed at scotthorton.org. You can get the whole show archives or the interview archives there. You know, in case you missed the show live, and, oh, good, it's got the whole show on there, and he blew the break, so I'll be able to hear that interview I wished I'd heard, and it'll be great. Right? Okay, good. ScottHorton.org. And join up the chat room with the guys. ScottHorton.org/chat. All right. Now, so much to cover, and it's Friday, which means I got to try to hurry, which is the kiss of death. I say that, and then I get stuck on one thing. Big debate over whether to call the Charleston massacre a terrorist act or not. Now, you know, narratives and PC and this and that, all that stuff usually just serves to obscure the truth of things. Okay, so I'm not into calling it terrorism because, you know, you're perceived to be on this side or that if you say it or don't. That's all kind of stupid. Well, it's not all kind of stupid because, you know, it's also true that I can understand why black people are saying, well, you better call it terrorism, because if anybody else did this to anybody else, you would. And so, what are you saying? Again, just screw you for being black, and your victims aren't as important? Because that's screwed up. I can understand why they feel that way. But it's still kind of beside the real point of whether or not it was terrorism. If you want to have a whole other thing where you call it that or not to decide whether you're on this side or that side of whatever other issue or whatever, then that's fine, I guess. But whether or not it actually was terrorism and whether that's useful as a term other than just equalizing the value of the victims, which I'm all for. Humans are humans. Simple as that. End argument. But what does it matter? What does it really matter if it's a terrorist act or not? Well, it was a terrorist act. It was planned as a terrorist act, clearly. And, but why do we care and what does it mean? Well, it means it's an attack on innocent civilians in order to provoke a political reaction. To provoke a reaction. That's what it's all about. That's what terrorism is all about. It's asymmetric warfare. He attacks innocent people. And then the consequences are pretty obvious. Doesn't matter whether he really thought them out that well, necessarily. The point is to provoke the reaction, preferably an overreaction. So, the more Democrats call for gun laws, the more right-winger, and accuse all right-wingers, including all Republicans and all Fox News and everybody, of basically all being skinhead neo-Nazi killers, which is a bit of an exaggeration. You know, you're talking about half the population of the country. But the more they act like that, the more the divisions are sharpened, right? The more people pick different sides. Same as Charles Manson trying to slaughter a bunch of rich white people and then blame it on Black Panthers and make it look like, you know, political blacks did it. Radical political blacks did it in order to cause a reaction, a violent reaction against them, and then a violent reaction in response to cause conflict. To rally more Nazis, to radicalize more right-wingers, make more of them Nazis who weren't before, you know, although I think that's probably unlikely to really accomplish much. but just to radicalize people against each other. You know? That's the point of terrorism. And so, for the 300 million of us who were the victim of this terrorist attack in this society, our responsibility is to be cool. Our responsibility is to not react. Our responsibility is not to exploit. Oh, I want to take your guns away now because a thing happened. I think maybe I can. Never let a crisis go to waste. You know, and the, you know, I don't know. The smart thing is for black people to be cool and recognize that the super majority in the 99 percentiles of American whites don't believe in this stuff, are not national socialists, are not skinheads, are not white separatists or white supremacists. And absolutely disapprove as much as they possibly could, right? Same as all Muslims are, you know, it's demanded that all Muslims denounce the ones who do terrorist attacks. Well, it should go without saying because how obviously true it is that virtually every single white person in America condemns this, has nothing to do with this, would never support anything like this. You know, in the 1990s, I used to know right-wing patriot movement, right-wing populist, patriot, even some militia guys, some Republic of Texas guys. I knew those guys. And I never heard them say Jew this or that or black people this or that or N-word this or that. They really didn't. And their worry was power, the Federal Reserve and the war and Bill Clinton. They didn't hate and pick on racial minorities. They were part of their American nationalism was, hey, if you're an American, you're an American. Who could deny that American blacks are Americans? Not them. Really? That's true. And, you know, I'm not saying all American right-wing populists are, you know, good on these issues uniformly or whatever, but... They were not white supremacists. They, you know, actual militia guys. Actual Republic of Texas guys. They weren't white supremacists. They just weren't. And so I understand. And this goes to the real point, which is why do black people feel like the victims still, like things never change from Jim Crow? It's because of the cops. Those are the lynching parties now. This kind of thing hardly ever happens. It's horrible. Horrible as it is. This hardly ever happens. I read a news story at the New York Times, actually, or I think it was Washington Post or something very official like that, AP or something, where they went and trolled all the white supremacist websites. And those guys were like, man, we're not in favor of killing and don't blame us for this. And, you know, they're a bunch of jerks. But this isn't their policy to do these kinds of things all the time. You know, that's what this guy is trying to start. And he's, of course, he's failing. Well, I don't know, of course, but. Seems to be. They all are distancing themselves from this kind of thing. So anyway, that's the whole deal, is people just got to understand each other on real terms. And, you know, I don't mean put emotions aside or whatever, but just be realistic, you know? And, you know, I don't know. Black people are taking over the country. I think it was John Stewart or one of these guys was saying, well, think of how black people feel. Oh, it was John Stewart. Think of how black people feel. They're from here. Their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents and great-great-great-grandparents, they're from here. Descendants of the slave, West African slave trade. You know, they're from here. And they hardly ever get any political power at all. And when they do, this guy came. That was, you know, at the heart of this massacre was the assassination of a state senator, the minister of that church. A church which, by the way, is almost 200 years old, 190-something years old, was once burnt to the ground because they were plotting a slave revolt in there. Had all this storied history. It was an assassination of, you know, a little bit of black power in America. Come on. Black people are taking over. Really? Black people run Wall Street? Black people run the Federal Reserve? J.P. Morgan and Citigroup and Lockheed and the House and the Senate, the CIA and the Pentagon. Now, what kind of fantasy is this? That when the slightest bit of black power is represented in American democracy, it has to, you know, result in this kind of reaction. In 2015. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, y'all, welcome back. And sorry, you know, I lost my train of thought in there somewhere. I wanted to get back to the point about the reason why black people are so terrified and act like they're, or act, talk like, at least, they're living in the 1950s, is it's because of the cops. They were already completely and totally out of control. And for black people, that much worse. But now, they're so much more militarized, so much more hopped up on steroids, and so much more certain that they will always get away with it. They're just killing people every day. Two and three people a day, every day in America. Hundreds of SWAT raids. Hundreds of SWAT raids. And then, amazingly, only two or three deaths per day at the hands of cops in this country. And yeah, most of those, again, against the politically powerless. So, look, if you're some meathead cop, how do you identify the politically powerless easily? Go by skin color. The darker their skin color, the less of a chance that their uncle's a state representative. And then if their uncle's a state representative, maybe, you know, a Nazi will come and kill him and nine people at the church. Put an end to that. But anyway, so that's why they feel so under siege. It's because of the police state. And the first and foremost solution has got to be a movement for accountability for killer cops. Accountability for killer cops. Say it with me. Make it a hashtag. Turn it into a slogan at the ballgame. Black Lives Matter, yes, of course, but okay, so now what are we doing? What are we doing? Accountability for killer cops. That has to be the standard. Not their best friend, the local assistant district attorney, is in charge of double-checking their actions. Somebody else has got to do it. Somebody from outside has got to do it. And the focus has got to stay on the cops. What this guy Roof did is absolutely horrifying. And I can see, again, why from a black person's point of view, this is all just par for the course. There is no difference between Zimmerman and Roof and your local deputy sheriff. It's all white supremacy in action. And I guess that's true. But, you know, I don't know. What are you going to do about Roof and Zimmerman? Ban everybody, especially poor, politically powerless black people, from having guns? Nah, I don't think so. The biggest threat is the cops. And so accountability for cops, I think, has got to stay at the forefront, the focus of this madness. Because after all, this is this massacre, this is 3 days worth of cops killing people in America. Mostly blacks. Well, not mostly blacks. Mostly whites, actually, but proportionally, for 13% of the population to be anywhere near half, you can see how they see it. But yeah, no, and that's the whole thing, too. That's why we ought to actually really be able to do something about it now, because police brutality and police, murder at the hands of officer-involved gunshots here in America is not just for black people anymore. It's everybody. It's people, you know, like this kid they murdered the other day, just for passive resistance, basically. You can see the video of it. He very well could have an uncle who's a judge. And this is, or who, you know, helps run the local, the state Democrat Party or something, you know? They're doing this to everybody now. And so we ought to be able to really rally a thing for police state rollback, accountability for the modern day lynch mob, the local deputy sheriff's department, the local city police department in your area. And of course, first and foremost in that is ending the war on drugs. Drug possession, and for that matter, the war on guns. Drug and gun possession charges against poor minorities are, you know, you take all the violence out of it and look at just those convicts in prisons, and you're talking about millions of Americans. Well, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands anyway. There are two million people in prison right now, and it's approaching or somewhere around 7 million if you count everybody who is in jail on parole and probation. Although I'm not sure how it breaks down more specific than that. There's still, what, probably at least 3 or 4 million, probably 3 in jail or prison right now. And what percentage of those are there just because they're a minority who's there on a gun rap? Like the story the other day where the guy had to shoot his own dog for attacking his daughter with his mother's rifle. And they said, nope, you're a convicted felon. You're never allowed to use a firearm or hold a firearm under any circumstances. Blam, we're nailing you to the wall. Black guy. Off to prison you go. Get paid 2 cents an hour to work for corporate America. Hey, it's slavery, but it's allowed. 13th Amendment allows, once you've been convicted of a possession charge, they can enslave you, all right. It's right there in the 13th Amendment. Check it out. All right, now, what time is it? Ah, jeez. Ah, jeez. Torture. Jeb Bush to Hannity. Nah, torture, I don't think that's necessary. We don't need it. Oh, and then check it out. It's not the law. Ooh, what a passive voice. Very soft way of saying it's against the law to torture people. Jeb Bush said that to Sean Hannity. And then Hannity kind of freaked out and pressed him further saying, well, but, you know, maybe after 9/11, right? And Jeb Bush said, well, you know, oh, yeah, I mean, I think it was appropriate at the time, given what we, you know, the uncertainty and under attack. And, oh, it was appropriate. It was also appropriate to change the policies once we had enough history. So it goes back even at the end to shouldn't be torturing people. But Sean Hannity had to poke him with a stick to make him say, oh, but, you know, I mean, I'm not saying my brother should be in prison or anything. Wow. Jeb Bush, I'm amazed at his stupidity. I mean, he's the son of a Bush. He's as dumb as a damned rock, but wow, I'm pleasantly surprised to find out the goofballery in our presidential frontrunner. What an idiot. What a loser. But the Senate did vote to ban torture over the leadership's opposition. And there's a write-up at The Atlantic that names all the senators who voted against it. 21 Republicans voted against it. All the Democrats supported it. And, of course, torture is already illegal. It's been illegal in America since before the Constitution, since before the Articles of Confederation. Or right around the time of the Articles of Confederation in the 1770s. Banned by executive order by George Washington during the Revolutionary War. And ever since, with no variation, only addition of further bans, military, civilian, and constitutional and otherwise. Yes, the Fifth and Eighth Amendment both ban torture. Right there in the charter that allows the government to exist in the first place, the so-called social contract, number 5 and number 8 say no torture. Can't torture. You do not have the authority to torture people. Anyway, so the Senate has passed this, and I guess, what's the word on the House? Of course, scum John Cornyn voted against it. Marco Rubio skipped it. I guess Rand Paul voted for it. So that's good. Voted with John McCain on that one. And then this is very important, too. And, man, I've been meaning to get to this. U.S. appeals court strikes down Guantanamo conviction of bin Laden's spokesman. Because, see, it's not a war crime to be a spokesman for a war criminal. And this kind, well, the ruling said the reach of, quote, military commissions does not extend to the trial of domestic crimes in general, or inchoate conspiracy in particular. So, there you go. Nothing but overturned convictions and ridiculous prosecutions of chauffeurs and cooks and drivers and children. And meanwhile, you know, any federal prosecutor in New York could have had Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin al-Shib and a few of those others who actually did it. Could have had them locked up in the Supermax awaiting their execution in, what, I don't know, 45 minutes? The time it takes Saddam Hussein to drop chemical weapons on London? All right. Oh, good news in the Iran talks. They're dropping the PMD bogus demand.